Hi, my name is Chip Spear, and you're listening to Earth Plus 30. Welcome. I'm a pretty sociable guy. I like talking to people. I like hearing their stories. I like learning about where they got to where they happen to be. This podcast is the result of one of those situations where I met Sarah Evans going out to lunch with my girlfriend and getting up from the table, walking over to a friend and being introduced to this woman who had started this incredible nonprofit by the name of Well Aware. We started a conversation. I followed up with her and one thing led to another, and I was totally intrigued by who she was, what she had done, and where she was going with this organization that I wanted to have a podcast. So with that, I want to introduce you to Sarah Evans. Sarah, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. I will say to our listeners that we had a little bit of a problem connecting. Our schedules were difficult to connect. And then once we did a recording and I had all sorts of technical problems, so we stopped and we finally got things together here. So, Sarah, welcome. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you about your incredible organization, Well Aware. I would like you to tell us a little bit about what your organization is and why it exists. You know, Well Aware is working on building these wells in Africa. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, my pleasure.
We are an international nonprofit, and we work closely with communities in East Africa designing clean water infrastructure and funding and implementing those projects. And we've been doing that for about 10 years. And when I started doing the work, I did not necessarily know, well, what I was doing at all. But once I was in the work for a couple of years, I realized how critically important it was that organizations were doing this work a little bit more responsibly. So we designed a model based on the failure of other projects so that we could create lasting clean water projects for communities and then scale our work and share the model.
Tell us a little bit about some of those things that you saw that were problems that you thought you could fix.
It's a very good question. So, you know, even on the first and second water well that we drilled, and we do water wells and pipeline work and rainwater harvesting and rehabilitation, and then hybrids of those different types of projects. I kind of had an instinct, even in the beginning, that there was just a real lack of community engagement. So that, and also a lack of people on the ground who were experts in, you know, drilling water wells. So that was my sense of things. So I put together a team of experts, and they are hydrogeologists and engineers. And we even did a study a couple of years later on over 200 different broken water systems in Kenya and what the reason for failure was. And the number one reason for failure was some kind of lack of technical expertise. And that could be that the borehole was simply not drilled deep enough, or the pump was missized, or that the community did not understand the technical maintenance of the system. But then a close second was this missing piece with the communities. Communities were not engaged in the process. They were not asked about the design and their development plans, and they weren't trained in any way. So,
excuse me for interrupting, but how would a community need to be involved in the design or something like that? You know, what difference would that make?
It's a really good question, because I think a lot of people just don't realize it's such a big factor. But communities, they've been there for generations, mm-hmm. and they have experience with trial and error and wins and losses. And so they're the best people to inform us of what the potential development is in the community and who are the stakeholders in the community who can be responsible for the system and who needs to be served and in what way. So these are really critical pieces when we put together the puzzle in designing a system so that we know who we're going to serve, how many people we need to serve, who's going to take care of the system, and who we need to talk to know that the rest of the community is going to be engaged around this new project that is very, very valuable to them, so that it will last a long time and they rally around it and really take ownership of the project.
Wow. I never realized it. You would think that other nonprofits, if they've come in and built these various wells, and you said that there have been huge numbers of
wells that were actually drilled or built or whatever that failed for all these various reasons. You would think that they would have thought about this or at least talked to more people or something. I don't know. It seems odd to me.
It did to me too. And it's a growing discussion and a growing awareness. I think to nobody's fault, because we're a more developed society, we have things that work for us. Mm-hmm. And we often make the assumption that what works for us is going to work for these other people in need. And that's just usually not the case. So I say this a lot, but you know, as an organization and our philosophy as a team is that we're not ambassadors for our own beliefs and philosophies over there, but rather, you know, we want to be ambassadors of their knowledge and their experience and their plans for development, and then bring that back to our donors here and explain what they need. And that's the disconnect. And it's kind of a high number of international NGOs that don't have a lot of community work or technical expertise on their team. So that is a missing piece. And you did mention the failure rate in this industry. And unfortunately, only about 40% of the water wells that are done in Africa are working a year later, which is a devastatingly...
Oh my God, that's horrible.
It is. It is. And these communities, they get their hopes up and they move their families closer to the water system and they invest their own resources and make plans. And then the water system disappears in 6 months and it's almost leaving them in a worse situation than they were before. Mm-hmm. We refer to this as the second global water crisis because it is such a big issue.
Second, what was the first? What did you consider the first?
Well, that almost 2 billion people lack access to safe, reliable drinking water.
So talk to me a little bit about the scale of this problem and some of the other statistics about water in that area of Africa.
So it's really interesting. The people most impacted by the problem are women and children because they just culturally bear the burden of collecting the water, cleaning the water, and making sure water is available for the family. So when clean water does become available, and if it is truly sustainable, it transforms their lives. And that's incredible. The time that women spend walking to get water that's usually not even clean precludes them from anything else in life. So they don't get to nurture their families the way that they probably want. They do not get to engage in business and contribute to the economy of the family or the community. And then it, you know, that really also contributes to this gender inequality that holds communities back from progress. And then kids aren't going to school if there's not clean water there, especially young girls when they hit puberty. If there is no way for them to have hygiene at the school, they miss a week of school a month, they fall behind and they drop out. Mm-hmm. And then the data around that is really interesting too, because for every additional year a girl is in school, her future income goes up 12%.
Wow.
So big, big impact, not just for her and her family, but for the region.
I stole just a couple of pieces of information from your website, which is really terrific. And I just want to say it's wellawareworld.org. But you stayed on that website right on the front. 400 million school days are lost per year, I believe it is, by kids who are sick with water-related illness, right?
Yeah. Diarrhea disease. Yeah.
Wow.
It's the number one cause of death for kids under five in these areas. And it's that water that is not safe to drink.
And you say also that women spend 200 million hours per day collecting water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, that is just unbelievable. Unbelievable.
It is.
So tell me a little bit about your story. I mean, you're building these wells in Africa, in Kenya and Tanzania, but how did you get there? Where did you come from and how did you connect to this amazing program?
I don't think that I have a likely path to be where I am now. I was born in rural Australia, but we moved to the States when I was five. And don't worry, I'm not going to tell you my whole life story.
It's pretty interesting from what you mentioned before, though, I must say.
It is kind of a crazy story. When I lived in Australia, when I was young, we lived off the land. We were off the grid. And so we did not have running water or electricity. And a lot of people say that maybe that's why I'm so cozy in these places with just the basics. You know, I ended up going to university at the University of Texas at Austin and went on to law school and started working at a finance firm doing compliance and then moved on to working at a law firm back in Austin. I met a friend, or we became friends, and she was working on a project in Kenya. Mm-hmm. I'd been to Africa on, you know, sort of tourist visits, but never really seen or spent time with communities. She wanted to raise some money for some of the cattle and goats because there was a severe drought in Kenya at the time, and the livestock were dying for the Maasai in Kenya. Now, mm-hmm. livestock is the livelihood for the Maasai. And I thought, well, yeah, I want to help with this. And her father was Maasai, and it was a very compelling cause. And with my legal background, I was going to help with the paperwork and some fundraising. And I got really, really interested in the cause and the issue. And the more I read about it and the more I talked to people about it, I realized that the root cause of the livestock problem and the economy in these community was the lack of water. And then all of these other horrible things in the community, the infant mortality and the kids not in school, were also a result of water. So I told my small group of friends at the time who were involved in this project, you guys, maybe we should just drill a well instead. And they said, sure, let's do that. And so we decided that we were going to raise the money, and we did with a really weird campaign and flew to Kenya a few months later, and we drilled our first water well.
So how did you find the people to help you all the way in Africa? I think, well, here I am in Texas, and I'm going to drill a well in Africa. How am I going to get the equipment? Where am I going to find the people, the expertise? What's it going to take? I mean, the logistical issues seem to be almost like a nightmare and quite a real problem. So that must have been a pretty incredible piece of project management as well as just the fundraising effort, right?
Yes and no. Because I will readily admit these days that that first project we got really lucky on. You know, I've always not been shy to ask questions and mm-hmm. ask for support and thoroughly research people and hunt them down and recruit their help. But when we did that first water well, I was also looking around at other projects when we were in country, and they were all broken. And uh-huh. I realized that we didn't know what we were doing. But because that first project made such a huge impact on my heart and on my soul, I wanted to figure out, well, how I could do this work for a long time, and uh-huh. also how I could do this work in the right way, how we could create a model that would be able to fund and implement these projects that would actually last. And so I did that.
Oh, that's pretty incredible. So you built that first well. How did you expand your operations, and what was your strategy for building that out?
That's a good question. Well, part of my strategy was selling my house and my car. I don't necessarily recommend, but I knew that this was what my life was going to be. But I went to work identifying what the expertise was, carry out the work, identifying these people, and then emailing them until they got sick of me and responded and said they would help. And through that, I learned a lot about the importance of hydrogeology, and it is not hydrology. I made the mistake a lot in the early days, but my team corrected me.
Well, tell people what the difference is, or tell me, you know, I don't, whether it's a mispronunciation or they're two separate things.
They are. They're two separate fields. And hydrology is a general field relating to water. Hydrogeology mm-hmm. is the study of water in the ground. Mm-hmm. So it's a big difference. It does not mean that hydrologists cannot offer value in this sector. It's just that hydrogeology is so key to executing a water well that you drill that is successful and maximizes the yield. Mm-hmm. I learn a lot daily still from these people. They're brilliant. And I get to watch their incredible work on the ground. And I'm very lucky for that.
So how have you expanded that educational system about community support? Is that something that changes from village to village or town to town or whatever, depending on what the situation is? Or do you have a certain group that goes in and does assessments? Or how does that all work?
That is also a very good question. We do not have a template solution, and we never will, because every community is different. Even if it's in the same county or the same tribe, every community has different experiences and different plans for development. So We start with accepting a project request form from a community. And from there, we have several different checklists. But when we know that could be a potential project, we initiate a field evaluation. So from the very first moment that we set foot in a community, we only ask questions. So we really want to know what the heartbeat of the community is and, you know, who's driving the development and who is going to be the most responsible people to oversee the success of the project. So we tailor design every single project based on, well, the topography and the hydrogeology, but also the community input. And the only way we can do that is if we really get to know them. And sometimes that takes a day and sometimes it takes several days and lots of tea, lots of long drives out into the field. But because we are committed to having 100% success rate, we will do what it takes to make sure if it's a viable project that the community is ready for the project to be there.
So how do you see this kind of expanding in the future? You know, what kind of plans do you have to impact more people? Or are you keeping it as a one day at a time type of effort?
So, you know, the work of WellAware has been scaling over the years, and we plan to continue to scale within East Africa. Mm-hmm. I also think that we're going to scale to a certain point until the model, the successful model, could be compromised.
Right.
So what I did a couple of years ago, and also in response to other nonprofits reaching out to WellAware to ask for our guidance and support to help with their project work, we formed another company, and the new company is called Well Beyond, and we consult for other NGOs, other nonprofits to help them better understand the type of work that they're doing, better understand the communities and the technical side so that they can raise their success rate as well. So we want to grow WellAware on the nonprofit side, and now we have this other company that can support other nonprofits to improve and enhance their work. And that is how we plan to spread the model, improve the work globally.
Well, I think that's really important. You know, one of the things that I've always thought about with my effort is to use what it is that people tell, or, you know, their stories, and use it as a model for other organizations or other people that are trying to do something that's impactful, because it's a kind of lessons learned. What did I learn from doing this? And I can share that information. And so much of what we do could be accelerated if we kind of shared those things more. At least that's my own feeling. And it seems that starting almost like a consulting company on this is, God, what a great thing.
I'm excited.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about the response that you've received from that effort as well.
That response has been pretty, I'll let you in on a little bit of my personal life. It's been very busy lately.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we have identified and we're planning the recruitment of a new executive director for the nonprofit, which I'm very excited about.
Oh.
I will remain very involved, and I'm the chair of the board of the nonprofit.
Of the new one, or the, you know, WellAware?
The first.
Oh, the first. I see.
Yeah, WellAware. But as the CEO of the new company, we are getting more and more requests all the time. So we also are developing a software, and something I have not yet mentioned as a key piece of a successful water project in a developing country is the maintenance of these water projects.
Hmm.
It's not something that organizations tend to spend a lot of time and resources on, but statistically, it is a really big factor in a lasting system. So, and in my work over the years, I've realized that the communities, first of all, they lack knowledge of the system and they lack instruction on keeping the system going for a long time. And this is outside of WellAware. And when we have been called in to troubleshoot something that is going wrong with a water system, it's typically something that's really straightforward. It's just that there is not the knowledge on the ground to be able to fix what is wrong. And so people can go weeks or even months without water because the system is down. And every day that a water system is not working, it reduces the chance that the system will ever work again. So through the new company, Well Beyond, we've also been developing a software. It's a smartphone app that we put in the hands of the communities or nonprofit boots on the ground so that they can troubleshoot these basic issues, run diagnostics, but also get quarterly maintenance pings to get in front of issues they may have. It also offers remote chat support so they can stay in touch with the technical team to better understand the system and fix the system and not have to spend money getting a technician out.
Wow, that's pretty incredible.
Yes. And so we're working on a very, very big project, getting one of our new NGOs onto that software in 3 weeks.
Oh, my God. So are you going to spend most of your time on that new effort rather than WellAware?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, WellAware, it was my first baby, you know. I will never, ever be separated from WellAware, but I will probably devote the majority of my time to the new effort. It's set up too, so that the new company is not a nonprofit, it's a for-profit. So The profits that the new company makes will go back to the nonprofit. So it's also a fundraising model for the nonprofit. So I'm excited about how this is going to play out.
Does this mean that there's possibly a car and a bigger apartment in your future?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I mean, maybe.
The car's nice. You know, I found it to be handy once in a while.
Right? Yeah, I know. And funny though, in my journey over the past 10 years that this has been part of my life or all of my life, I've become so comfortable with very little. Mm-hmm. And that's probably through my, you know, work with the communities and understanding how happy they are when they just have the basic necessities. So I don't know. But yeah, probably a little bit of bigger apartment would be nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, it's amazing what something like that forces you to think a little bit differently. Just because of circumstances, had to move like about 4 times over 10 years. And I want to tell you about downsizing. Boy, I got rid of things because the more I had to move it, the more I had to carry. And I was getting pretty sick of it. And it's amazing. I was still living perfectly fine and I didn't need all that stuff.
Exactly.
You know,
we tell people that travel with us to Kenya, and I experienced this in the early days, but coming home from these trips, when we're working with the communities, you start to feel guilty, right? You know, mm-hmm. you have all of these, truly they're luxuries. Just the fact that water comes out of the sink and right. we have a toilet that we flush is a luxury. And I try to tell people who come along, who are our guests, that the feeling of guilt isn't productive. But what we can do is transform that into gratitude.
Right.
But it's also a good opportunity to explore how you might simplify. Because you start to understand like that a lot of things kind of don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a blessing. And we try to share that message.
That's so, so, so important. And so what do you think, you know, with all these NGOs and looking at the scale of the problem in like East Africa, Kenya, Tanzania, and I'm sure that it probably extends in a lot of other areas throughout Africa, but how much of an impact do you think you'll make over time? Do you think that you can really transform a lot of these countries?
You know, I'm actually really hopeful that we can. And through the new company, we already have additional project work in Haiti and in West Africa. And so I am hopeful. And I think it's amazing that these organizations are reaching out to us to ask us for help.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that was the case 10 years ago. I just don't think it was an awareness within the sector at that time. But I'm seeing now that people are saying to themselves, you know what? I think we're not truly serving communities the way that we intend to, right? Or we're not as cost effective as we can be. So they're looking for this niche expertise that we have to support them in getting better. Mm-hmm. So I think we can have a big impact. I really do.
So how are you getting your message out more with this new company and kind of what is its marketing plan? You know, because it seems like you've been successful. You have a model, you know, that's adaptable to a lot of different situations that it seems other NGOs could take advantage of to be more successful themselves if they knew about who you are and what you've done, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't know. Do you have a marketing plan?
Do I? No. I'm always trying to develop a better one. That's for sure. Whatever I'm doing, it's not good enough. That's what I know.
But, you know, we've only taken on partners through word of mouth so far.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the launch of the new software partners, we will have some new resources and I can hire some more people. And at that time, we'll think about what our marketing is. I haven't quite been ready for that, but I think in the coming months, I will be, and I'm excited.
No, that sounds great. Absolutely great. So this has been a really wonderful, amazingly interesting story, and your organization is just really inspiring, especially how you got there, you know, and change, you know, you changed your life and, you know, you have a daughter and you expose her or educate her into the ways of the world that are really unlike anything that they would or she would normally experience, right? In just the usual, you know, Texas town or around Austin. You are around Austin, right?
We are. Yeah. And I think you're right about that. I do wonder sometimes about our unorthodox lifestyle, but she's great. You met her. She's very confident. She comes with me all the time when I have speaking engagements and will often take the mic, and she's quite good. So I think I do have a succession plan here.
All right. Well, what does she do when she gets up on stage or she's answering questions or whatever?
She has heard me on so many phone calls and seen me on stage. It's funny, you know, I'll be doing an interview or something on stage and she always will video my speech. Mm-hmm. It's really cute. And she'll like say, Mommy, you could have done this, or maybe you should have said that, or you should sit this way. And she's 7.
Wow. That's pretty perceptive.
Love it. She's great.
So I wanted to ask you a question as Earth Plus 30. I'm, you know, looking at the whole world 30 years from today. And one of the reasons that I wanted to talk to you was because the work that you're doing is having a tremendous impact today, but it's going to have such a much bigger impact, you know, further down 30 years in the future because of how you're transforming these communities and turning them into really productive places where people are healthy and living better lives and able to go to school and able to do things that they've never been able to do before. So if I pose a question to you and say, well, tomorrow you are going to be the ruler of the world, what are the three things that you think are the most important things that we have to deal with? And if I can just, I want to take climate change off the table because that's such a, you know, the monster in the room, kind of the pink elephant in the room. Like just three other things come to the top of your head about things that we need to address to make our world a much better place in the future.
Wow. That's the hardest question I've ever been asked.
Well,
this is probably because of my bias and I live in the world, but and it relates to climate change in lots of ways, but access to water is so important, and not just that we're making sure that people have it, but that it's not, that it's not privatized.
Right.
This is a growing concern in different parts of the world, but it's not something that we can do without. And it's going to be critical,
right,
to avoid just a huge gap between, you know, people's access to everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it needs to be a stronger consideration, and not just in these developing countries, but in Texas.
Right.
And water infrastructure and water quality is, wow. Yeah, it's a very, very big deal. So that's my first answer.
Good.
Number two, you know, I'm a very data-driven person, and there's just a lot of really good information around gender inequality and how that set everything else back. Economy, domestic violence, things just get worse as gender inequality goes up. So,
boy, that's a really, really good one. Absolutely.
I'm not going to say I know how to fix it necessarily, but if I knew how, that would absolutely be a priority, as I am the leader of the world.
Yes, you are. Yes. Today you are the leader of the world. So
that's really scary. Oh, gosh. And then number three. Well, I almost hate to say this, but democracy is an interesting word. And I think an ideal democracy doesn't necessarily exist.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that if more of our nations globally could reach anything that's closer to democracy, I do think we could all make better progress together. I do. That's my, I guess, my legal / political background popping up, but I would wish for that.
Well, those are great. I thank you. I put you on the spot, you know.
Yeah.
You know, on my business card, which I handed you, you know, on the back of it is who owns the world?
Yeah.
And if it's not you and if it's not me, who is? Who does? Right? And I think that we all have to start acting like owners in order to make it better. So thank you so, so much. This was really great. And I really look forward to meeting you again in some unusual place like I did the first time.
I know. That was the first time. I'm so glad I met you. Thank you.
That was great. Well, thanks.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening today. Do you have an idea for a podcast? Let me know. Visit my website. You can contact me there or send me an email at chip@earthplus30.com. Until next time, this is Chip Spear.